Start things off with music recorded here in our studios in 2010. Simile Life, the name of the track, featuring Coco Quadrant on the vocals and production work from Robin Hannibal, who is our guest here in the studio. How are you doing, Robin?
Good. Thanks for having me.
It was a pleasure the first time around, and it's, you know, just as much of a pleasure this time around, especially just because you've been really, really busy.
Yeah.
Since the last time we saw you, and from what I remember, back in 2010, you'd kind of moved to Los Angeles, but I don't think you were living here permanently. But that has definitely changed.
Definitely, yeah. I think that was around the time that I moved. I think maybe we were here on some sort of promotional trip,
maybe
in start 2010, and then late 2010 I actually moved here. Yeah, I've been living here ever since.
How has that affected the way you put your music together, the way you create music? I would imagine being here as opposed to being back in Denmark has to have an influence on you.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I mean, it's had a great influence, and also it's had a great effect as well. I think that the music that I'm into and that I primarily create and compose and produce isn't a very Scandinavian sound. it's developed more and more, and yeah. there's a market for it now.
Yeah.
But at the time of me moving here and things slowly building in the States, that was definitely not the case. So that helped tremendously, finding like a base, mm-hmm. finding some kind of a core of listeners that understood what it is that I and the different projects that I'm included in wanted to do, mm-hmm. and wanted to achieve. And I think it's just, you know, no matter what it is that you do, getting the feeling that there is some kind of feedback, positive feedback, and that people can use it, definitely encourages you and influences you to wanna, you know, step it up and do it even more and get even more busy, and that's, I think that's predominantly the biggest difference between mm-hmm. living in Denmark and living here. And then, you know, also the musical DNA is different here too. The way that people listen to music, the way that they're much more, you know, positive and enthusiastic about music, it's very different. And then also, you know, soul music, which is, I'd say, like the base from where I distract a lot of influences and a lot of production and writing, it's just one of those genres that everybody can relate to here, and that everybody, you know, loves somehow or has some kind of involvement or mm-hmm. relation to.
Yeah.
And that's not the same in Scandinavia or even Europe. Mm-hmm. You know, there's definitely people that are into it, but
yeah, but it's more like little pockets.
Yep. And that's very different. So here you don't feel that disconnect, you know, if you mention that you do this and this and that, or, you know, where I'm from, very often you come in and you play your music and or you go to meetings and, you know, whatever, all the industry stuff, and they look a little bit down upon soul music still, you mm-hmm. know, as something that we can't really do, and, you know, that's from the other side of the Atlantic.
That's not our music.
Yeah,
or something.
It's
like
a little
that,
bit of hands off, yeah. You know. So that's changed, and then I think also what's just amazing about America is that because it's such a young country, everybody is not from here. You know, everybody moved here. Everybody is trying to make it. So there's a different respect from people not coming from here.
Yeah,
like people don't really care that much. Like they care about, you know, the elements, and they care about the material, the core of what it is that you do. So that's great. You know, you don't feel, oh, you're from Denmark, you make soul influenced music. It's not looked down upon at all. You know, it's like, wow, oh, that's really interesting. You know, that's almost, you know, exotic.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that that's maybe especially the kind of dynamic that you were talking about. It's especially true of Los Angeles,
yeah,
where there's certainly a lot of people who are native Angelenos, but Los Angeles, because of its size, because of everything that's here, and especially musically speaking, you know, it has this kind of gravitational pull,
totally,
from all kinds of different areas. And a lot of what you were saying in terms of the effect of Los Angeles seemed to be connected to being able to find audiences, and especially people, places to play the music, to hear the music. I was also wondering just how it's been kind of coming into community of musicians in Los Angeles as well.
It's been amazing. Yeah, it really has been. And you know, I feel like from day one, they really just welcomed us. And I remember very vividly some of the very first shows that, I mean, they weren't really shows. They were just basically, you know, me on a laptop playing off the tracks and then Coco singing to, mm-hmm, it, because we weren't prepared. Like, we thought we were just going to come over and say hi, you know, and all of a sudden it was expected for us to, like, do a, you know, an hour-long performance of some sort. You know, we couldn't even afford, yeah, getting a band over. And people just came to us, and these great, you know, musicians and producers, songwriters, people in the, you know, in the music, you know, business or industry or whatever, they were very, very open and very, you know, very encouraging and yeah, just really nice and just welcomed us, you know, and let us in. And I think that's a really, really great aspect of the Los Angeles music scene as well, is that you know, you're greeted with open arms.
Yeah.
There's just not the same, you know, there's not the same, yeah, I mean, I guess there's a competition, but there's not the same, you know, elbow type of thing that you sometimes see in other cities.
Okay.
You know, you it's very much a share.
Yeah.
Sharing is caring type of thing, and that was really great to experience as well. So I mean, the first trip we were, you know, we even stayed with some different, you know, DJs and radio DJs and label people and, you know, musicians, and it was great. And some of them we still have, and I still have contact with to this day.
In some ways, kind of, you know, and this was one of the things we talked about when you and Coco were here in 2010, like the kind of story of Quadrant and how people found the music is, you know, almost kind of like the like perfect kind of fairy tale for indie musicians.
Totally.
And in some ways, just because the circumstances are certainly different, but in some ways I almost feel like lightning kind of struck twice with the project Rye. And so could you talk a little bit, especially about where you, or how you hooked up with Mike Melosh, who does the vocals?
Yeah, well, it's a crazy story, actually, because with Mike, I hadn't known of his music for many years. And a funny little, you know, side note to one of the songs you played or projects, Boom Clap Bachelors,
mm-hmm,
that project was actually very inspired by some of Mike's first albums, because he's been releasing music for, I think, around 8 to 10 years.
Okay.
You know, so he's definitely not new to it. And it was very inspiring to hear somebody who was, you know, also not American, he's Canadian, mm-hmm, but he has a very, like, European sensibility. He's lived all over Europe. And he mixed, you know, what was kind of happening in Europe, like this, you know, European electronics, and mixed it with this kind of soulful vocals without it trying to sound, you know, like R&B, you know, like he just kind of distilled a few elements of it, like the emotional quality and the honesty and the sincerity.
Mm-hmm.
And he mixed it with, you know, modern music and modern programming. So that was really inspiring. And he was actually releasing music on all of his solo albums was on the same label as Quadrant, Plug Research. And the first time we were over here, the owner of Plug Research, he, you know, he was playing it to us. I knew it, and Coco hadn't heard about it before. And, you know, so we started listening to it in the car and stuff, and he started saying, well, it would be really interesting if you guys did something together. And then that kind of, led to him being offered to remix one of the Quadrant songs.
Mm.
And he then made a remix for it, and he had sung on top of it as well. He had done some background vocals. And I asked him, you know, if he could send over maybe the background vocals as well, because I really liked those. They gave me an idea for another song.
Mm-hmm.
So the start of the project was actually me remixing the remix, which I guess is also very modern.
Yeah.
But yeah, so, you know, he just called me up, I remember, one time out of the blue, and we just started to talk. And I think he was kind of ready to try something new as well. He had been making everything on his own for 10 years.
Yeah.
Very self-contained in every sense. And he was living in Berlin. I was living in Copenhagen at that time. And, you know, I told him about this idea I had of this song that he had remixed, and I'd made something new out of it. And he said, well, why don't I just come up to Copenhagen for a week and, you know, we'll see what happens. And I had a studio in Copenhagen fully equipped with, you know, drums, piano, and whatnot, and mixing desk and everything. And so he just came up, and we just, you know, just had fun for a week and just hung out and wrote songs. And that's actually where 3 of the 10 songs came from that week. And then it just developed from there. I think it stood still maybe for 8 or 9 months because I moved to the States. I moved to LA, and he was still living in Berlin. And then there was just one day where this new label, Innovative Leisure, they used to work at Stone's Throw, but they made this new label, and they asked me if I had any, you know, music that, you know, that I was really excited about. And I kept mentioning this one thing, this other thing, and this other thing, and they were all like, oh yeah, that sounds exciting. And I'm like, oh, and actually, you know, I started working with Mike Milosz, and like, and they just like they just flipped. I noticed, like, mm-hmm. they, you know, they just had small lights in their eyes. And it turned out that they were huge fans of Milosz's music, but always felt that it'd be interesting to hear it in another setup, you mm-hmm. know, or him working with somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just kind of it again. It just happened very organically. You
yeah.
know, it wasn't really forced upon anybody, or, you know, we weren't trying to, you know, make it happen this way. It just sort of happened, and they went back and they heard these demos, and they were just into it, and they you know, provided a budget and everything, and for Mike to start flying over. And then he met a woman in LA and I had a girlfriend at that time as well, and so the whole inspiration was also very much this newfound love, and that's also why the album's called Woman, because it's an ode or homage to women and the feeling of this, you know, newfound love.
It's one of the things that's interesting about the record and about the reception of the record, and a lot of it has to do with his voice, but also I think with the production, how everything kind of flows together. It kind of adds to this kind of deep tenderness that's in virtually every song. I'm trying to think of all the lyrics of the songs in my head. even regardless of some of the lyrical content, at times there's like really deep tenderness to it. And in some cases, I know for some reviewers, some listeners, they've actually feel like they've kind of been fooled, because Mike has this very particular voice. And like for me, growing up as a fan of Little Jimmy Scott, who also has that same kind of voice, where it's just like it's an otherworldly voice, and it's not the voice you expect to come out of the person who is singing. And so a lot of people felt like this was a woman artist. This is part of the, you know, and I've wondered what that kind of experience has been like for the two of you, because there's been a little, at least early in the year, there was a little bit of mystery kind of connected to Rai.
Yeah.
And so I was wondering just how that worked for you.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's been an advantage, and then I think at a certain point it also became not a disadvantage, but it became an old story, you know, for us to tell. But I think in many ways it also helped not sell the project, but, you know, if you look at most projects, there's always something that makes it, you know, stand out a tiny bit, you know, yeah. or it needs a story, you know. Even Jimmy Scott, as you mentioned, mm-hmm. which I'm a huge fan of, you know, he kind of transcends genders yeah. with his voice and how he looks and everything, and that is very much the case, I think, if you go back also and look at a lot of the interesting artists over the years, famous and non-famous.
Mm-hmm.
So it definitely helped in many ways, and we were aware of it to a certain extent. I mean, I've always known that Mike was a guy, so
yeah.
to me it wasn't really so much of a surprise, but it was something that we were talking about when we were making it, that we wanted it to be faceless.
Yeah,
because we were both making projects on the side as well, you know. That was kind of our, you know, main income.
Yeah.
So we didn't want people to already have a preconceived idea of what it would sound like. Or it'd be like, oh, it's that guy, and oh, it's that guy from blah 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 blah. Mm. So it's gonna sound like this.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the main reason. And then it just so happened that a lot of people think that he, you know, sounds like a girl, or like he could sound like a girl, but it wasn't ever something that I think he's probably heard it over the years.
I would imagine so too,
but it wasn't something that we tried to make into like a PR story, but we definitely wanted to add some mystery, because I think we both feel that this day and age it's all about, you know, like mass exposing
yeah,
everything,
yeah,
little
yeah,
thing you do, yeah. that it can be really nice sometimes to not tell the whole story
mm-hmm.
and let people fantasize and you know, imagine, like use their imagination and not get everything force-fed in front of them, you mm. know. That was the concept behind it.
Yeah.
And then because, you know, these were love songs, then we opted to call it Woman. And also, we wanted a name that could mean a lot of different things. It could be a female name. It could be a male name. It could, you know, it's also, you know, a product. It could be a lot of different things. So that's where it came from. And then, you know, it gets to a point sometimes where you can't really control what's going on, you know. And it became this, you know, why don't they want to tell us who we are? And then, you know, like, I think the first songs we had on iTunes, it said our names. It's like, Rye is Robin Hannibal, Mike Milosh. Like, it was never really hard to actually find.
Yeah.
But it became this great web story or internet story that we didn't want people to know who we were. But we never really did. We didn't use any energy on, you know, telling everybody who we were.
Yeah.
Which I think is probably what made it feel like that, you know. But to at least to me, there's a big difference between, you know, shouting it on the rooftops of LA and then just, you know, just keeping it, you know, letting it kind of happen by itself, like letting it take its life of its own.
Yeah, and it's a fairly rare thing these days to have that happen, especially, I mean, with the digital age that we live in. It's very, very easy for people to
yes.
kind of figure things out and find things out. And I think that's one of the, you know, I'd kind of wondered, having not spoken with you too much, and I a lot of times I try and stay away from interviews that other people do.
Yeah.
But I'd known that when the group had performed live, that a lot of instances that done without much of the house lights on
yeah.
the band
yeah.
and kind of de-emphasizing that, and the focus then had to be on the music itself
yeah.
and more of the listener and what the listener takes away from the music.
Totally. I mean, that's the whole concept of it. And it's not meant to be this, you know, big philosophical reaction of some sort. I mean, it's not a dogma, but it's definitely just, it just felt right, you know, because we did make the whole album together.
Mm.
You know, it wasn't an internet thing, or it wasn't beats that, you know, Mike's jammed on top of. We sat in that room and we made everything together.
Mm.
You know, we wrote everything together. We made all the music together. So it didn't feel like it should have, I mean, either it should have our faces on everything, or it's, you know, it shouldn't.
Yeah.
So we just opted for the latter. And I think, you know, I think it actually makes the music more sensual and more romantic when you don't have, you know, a guy or two guys standing there trying to, you know, look cool. And I have total respect for people that does that. It's not that. I just didn't think, and we didn't think, that it really matched this music and this album.
Yeah. Let's hear a little bit from this album, from the record From Rye. The name of the album is Woman. The song we're going to listen to right now is The Fall on KPFK and Melting Pot. Music from the group Rye here on KPFK and Melting Pot, the name of the song The Fall, and featured on the record Woman from that group. Robin Hannibal does the production work for, or much of the production work for that group, in addition to a few others, and he is our guest here in the studio. I was wondering if we could talk a little bit about the production, you know, putting together this music for this particular group, and especially thinking about the kind of differences and similarities, I guess you could say, between the work that you do in Rye and the work in Quadrant.
Sure.
And I guess the first part of thinking about this was how you keep these things separate.
Yeah.
Because a lot of times, you know, artists have, especially producer, and I sometimes feel a little weird just calling you a producer, which we can talk about later
yeah,
on.
Yeah.
But, you know, producers kind of have like a sound or an aesthetic.
Sure.
And a lot of times when you, that's part of the, you know, being a producer and having a name is
yeah.
your name is attached to it and it has that particular kind of sound. And there are some elements certainly that are shared between these two kind of most prominent groups
yeah.
that you're working with, but there are also some fairly stark differences. And so could you say a little bit of something about that, just kind
sure.
of keeping the differences between Rye and Quadron?
Yeah, I mean, the main difference is obviously that Quadron, it's a girl singing named Coco, and with Rye, it's a guy called Mike that is singing. And both projects kind of have the same setup, where it's me and a singer, and we write the songs together, and then, you know, I produce it, and they have an influence on the production as well, to a point in what they want, like mm-hmm. or to a level of how much they want to be involved. Sometimes, you know, it's a little bit. Sometimes it's more. Sometimes they're vocal about things. Sometimes they're not. So yeah, I mean, I guess what makes my situation sometimes a little bit confusing is, or you know, knowing or not figure not knowing what to exactly call me or define me as,
mm-hmm.
is that I am both a producer and a songwriter, and that's. I think that's the main difference, where, you know, most producers are producers and most songwriters are songwriters.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also because I came from the you know, the independent world of music and slowly slipped into, I guess, what you can call somehow the mainstream or the bigger version of the music business. And in that, it's more often that the different, you know, types of work are divided. You know, so there's a producer, there's a songwriter, there's a top line writer. You know, there's maybe even somebody that just does the lyric, somebody that engineers, somebody that mixes, somebody that does arrangement.
Mm-hmm.
It just so happens I do all of those things.
Yeah.
And it's been more just because there wasn't the budget to have all these different people. So I took on all these different people. The only thing I don't do is play live. And it's simply just because I do all these things, I don't have time to practice one instrument.
Mm.
B, my interests lie in this field. Like, that's who I am, like that's what I'm capable and really good at doing.
Yeah.
And that again makes it even more complicated, because in both Ryan Quadron I'm the artist as well.
Yeah.
And that happened because, again, I came from this independent music world where there isn't enough money to pay a producer to make your album. So, and because I'm also writing the songs or co-writing the songs and actually creating the music, not just producing it, I'm actually also involved in the artistic expression of it.
Yeah.
And also down to the level of the music videos, the art, the name of the bands, you know, everything, the administrative part of it, all of that. So it's something that was necessary at the point, but definitely now sometimes can be a bit of a hassle to try and explain, because, you know, here or at, you know, in the mainstream music business thing, you're either, you know, an artist or you're a producer.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a little bit of both.
Yeah.
But I actually always wanted to be a producer and a songwriter mainly. It just there wasn't, you know, there wasn't the surroundings for it. So I kind of had to jump on the other wagon as well. And that is also why Rye in many ways is a little bit like faceless, and and nameless to a certain extent, because, you know, I'm not so interested in the whole, you know, being, you know, a celebrity. And also with Quadrant, Coco is definitely, you know, the one that mm-hmm. is mostly exposed
upfront,
and
yeah.
upfront, you know, and it's also something that we agreed on, and we even wanted to do more, but because I'm also an artist, signed as an artist, and we're a duo, then, you know, it's a part of it as well. And I know that, and I don't shy away from it when it's necessary. Mm-hmm. I understand that, but, you know, it's a little tricky.
A lot of room for musical schizophrenia.
Yes.
And just, in especially, I guess, now that you have these... And you know, this year,
yeah.
you know, the Rye record, I guess the record was finished in 2012.
Yeah.
But really caught on at the beginning of this year. And
yeah.
I think got picked up by Sony at the beginning of this year.
Polydor.
Yeah. Sorry. Okay. And the Quadrant record came out on Vest in Culture, which is kind of a subsidiary of Sony.
Yes.
And so both of these albums come out, one in the earlier year, one in the summer.
Yeah.
But both of them kind of prominent here in the same year.
Yeah.
And thinking about just the kind of process of making music. So now that they're both like these seem like part-time projects that are really full-time projects. When music comes to you now, does it come kind of with the particular voices attached to it, or do the musical ideas just kind of come out and then you kind of figure out where they're going to go later on?
Yeah, I mean it's almost a two-part question, and the first part of it, like you're saying, with the Rye record coming out in March and the Quadrant record coming out in June, with 3 months in between, which isn't a lot, because normally you do press and stuff for half a year after the album comes out.
Yeah.
So I kind of got caught in, you know, like a double whirlwind, and. You know, when I tell people about this in the industry as well, they're like, you are signed two different places. You have two different acts and you're releasing them at the same time. Are you insane? And it was definitely not the plan, because the Rye album, like you said, was actually finished a year before it was released.
Uh-huh.
And the Quadrant album wasn't. It didn't have a release date. And then all of a sudden it had one, you know, and then there was like, you know, having to like finish it up and move on it. So everything just coincided, and it wasn't planned in any way. And in the midst of it, the odds of that happening looked very, very slim. You know, everybody involved, it looked very, very slim. And then there was a teeny bit of time where it was a little bit intense, because there was certain days where, you know, I could be two different places, you know, and then it, you know, you have to figure out how to get around that. But it wasn't for more maybe than a couple of weeks, and then actually, you know, it worked out just fine. And then what it also showed was that they helped each other, you know, the projects, because they are in the same world, but I guess in two different categories as well. One of them is, like, you know, then that's leading into your second question, is that, you know, Coco has a different voice. She's a woman. Mike has a different voice. He, you know, he's a guy as well. And the aesthetic is somewhat a little bit different also. So I very quickly know when I'm working on something what it will fit for, or I have an idea, and sometimes, you know, sometimes one of them don't like it, and I'll play it to the other one, and they like it, and then, you know, then we go, you know, and that's just how it is. And then other times there'll be something that I'll have lying around for years and years and years, and then I take it out and I'm like, that's actually that could be a pretty cool song, and then I'll use some of it, you know. And the great thing is, you know, if you write based on more the music than instead of the production, then you can always change things around. You can always take something or an idea from an old demo or idea composition and gel it with something else, because it's, you know, it's just chords, it's just, you know, melodies, and you can always transpose them and fix them and make them work together.
Yeah.
And in that way, it's actually not that complicated or not that difficult. It's sometimes me that makes it more difficult because I have all these different, you know, options.
Yeah.
But it's a good problem to have, a luxurious problem,
yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah. I do want to let you guys know you're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 in Santa Barbara, worldwide at kpfk.org. You're currently listening to Melting Pot, which is generally here every Sunday from 4 to 6 p.m. And today we have a guest in our studios. His name is Robin Hannibal. He is the producer, the conductor of a lot of different things, but most prominently here in 2013, he's had a couple different records with two different bands, Rye and the album Woman and Quadrin and their album Avalanche. And I think that if we kind of start to shift a little bit to talking more about the Quadrin record, a lot of what you said about how the Rye project came together explains a lot of the kind of sonic differences between the groups, mm-hmm. because I feel like from really both of these records now that we have two records from Quadrin, that both of these records, kind of the production style is a bit more referential to kind of influences that you've had and other artists who've clearly have been some of your favorites. And I felt like that was a little less clear with the Rye record and that kind of process of wanting to pull back and do something really different seems to really have explained that.
I think so too, and I agree with you. And I think also, you know, with collaboration with Mike is also a lot newer. And we actually only did those 10 songs that is on the album, you know. And for this album with Quadrin, we wrote I think 45 or 50 songs.
Oh wow!
Yeah, and then we chose 10. So the development was also different, and it's also different when you are working on your second album, no matter what it is that you do. You start becoming more selective, and also you start noticing certain patterns that you go into. And you do that because of your prior work with that project. You know, so you start like, this maybe sounds a little bit too much like that song that we had on that, you know. And then you get into that, and the first album you don't. So it feels like a bit more of an open field, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean the Quadrin album and the Quadrin project is definitely springs from or comes from our love for, you know, urban music, and there is more references just because though that is the music that me and Coco kind of share, like that we have between us that we kind of can understand and relate to, and the music that me and Mike relate to, I think, is a little bit different. It's different songs and it's different textures and it's different elements, you know. And because he's also a producer, the language is a little bit different, you know. Whereas with Quadrin, it's our love for Michael Jackson, Stevie Wonder, Marvin Gaye, and some of these greats, Sade, and those are the things that we kind of use to explain things to each other. So it is definitely a little bit more inspired by urban music and also has more references for sure.
And it seems like this record, in comparison to the first record, which I think had, I'm taking something back before I even say it. But I was going to say that it seemed like the first record had maybe more references, but actually this record has quite a few different reference points as well. But it seems like Avalanche has, like, there's a little bit more Michael in Avalanche the first record. And I'm wondering if part of that it relates to just where it was recorded and kind of the actual kind of recording process and being in Los Angeles.
Totally. It is. I mean, it's, you know, like, we don't want to get a little too fanatical, but I will say that there are certain things that are you know, kind of interesting. I mean, we did sign with Epic Records, that is under Sony, and Epic was the label that released all of Michael Jackson's solo albums. And also, we worked a lot out of a studio called Westlake, which was, you know, Michael Jackson and Quincy Jones' old stomping grounds, and where he did the bulk of his albums and music in the 80s and late 70s. So, you know, making the music on the same equipment, the same rooms, all this memorabilia everywhere, and also, yeah, using certain musicians that had either played with him or had been in connection with him, being signed by L.A. Reid and Tricky Stewart, who had both worked with him as well, definitely, you know, had an impact. And we also felt, you know, that we both had the belief that, you know, you need to step things up every time you do something, or you need to up the ante. You know, you need to try more. Yeah. You know, and sometimes trying more is less. But in this case, trying more was more, because the first album I had envisioned as to kind of showcase Coco's voice, so I never wanted it to be too full. I never wanted it to have too many vocal details as well, to, you know, wanted it to just kind of have space for, you know, Coco's voice. Basically this time around we thought it'd be interesting to kind of add more, you know, more harmonies, more vocal details, and more arrangement as well, and also because we had a budget for it, so we added, you know, a lot more players and more, you know, orchestral elements as well. So
yeah, let's hear a little, actually, in some ways, the, you know, the song brings together a lot of what you were just talking about. All the different elements that you were talking about is the track Neverland.
Yeah.
And so let's listen to this track. This is from Quadrant, from their record came out in the summer, a real kind of summer record, a perfect record for the summer. And one of the tracks from it, Neverland, right now, that you're going to hear on KPFK and Melting Pot.
Just say, and if you cry for help,
Music from Quadrant here on KPFK and Melting Pot. From the album Avalanche, released in June of this year, the song was Neverland. Robin Hannibal of Quadrant is here in our studios. We've been talking to him for about an hour here at KPFK and Melting Pot about these various projects. One of the things we were just talking about this, and it was something, you know, a difference between the first record and this record, but just entirely like in what you hear. Because as soon as I realized it, I listened to the other one and it was like, it was there all over the place and I couldn't believe it. I was like, why didn't I hear this? But like hearing Coco's voice over productions that don't sound exactly like what was on Off the Wall or Thriller, but kind of feel like they're in that spirit, like they have the feel of it. All of a sudden I realized how much her voice really sounds like Michael, like kind of little Michael Jackson, not at the time like that, but like when he was in the Jackson 5, there are a lot of things she does with her voice that sounds so much like Michael.
Totally. And I mean, he's the main inspiration, and you know, it's not even, you know, I'm not even making this up when I say that there would be a lot of times when we're at studios and you know, we wouldn't know where to go, or we were unsure if this was the right direction, and we would, you know, just look at each other and say in unison, like, what would Michael do? Like, we'd just literally be like, what would Michael do in this situation? And I think, you know, in a lot of people love Michael Jackson, so it's, you know, we're not trying to say that we know or understand him better or we love him more than anybody else does, but I think the way that we use him is just that he's an inspiration for how he wants to perfect everything. You know, this amazing drive and this amazing strive for perfection and doing something that, like, outdoing yourself all the time. I think that's how we use him the most, and thinking, you know, what would be the not obvious thing to do that would a lot of the times be what he would do, you know? And he threw a lot of curveballs, like, during his career. He definitely did. He definitely didn't make the same album and the same song again and again and again. Like, he had comfort zones and sweet spots like anybody else, but I think what's remarkable about him was that he was always looking for something new. He was always interested. He was always trying new things out, production techniques, different styles of songs. And a lot of his music is very conceptual as well, which is very inspiring when you're working on music too. And it was something that me and Coco kind of met through. It was through the love of Michael Jackson. Mm-hmm. So it's a language that we can kind of talk, you know, and sometimes we would put on a song and in the studio it's like, oh wow, like when he does that, like that's, you know, so dope. Like, let's see if we can, you know, make that into our own, or, you know, get inspired by it. So you're totally right about it. And this one, and there's a couple of other songs as well where we were definitely trying to, you know, get the inspiration, the divine inspiration. Yeah,
it's one of the things that I appreciate about the work that you do in all these different areas. And I mean, at the top of the show, we played a set of you know, I guess like five different projects: Squadron, Boomclap Bachelors, Rye. Those are still pretty much ongoing.
Yeah.
There was the collaboration with Philip Owusu, and Owusu and Hannibal, and also kind of your own project as Bobby. And the thing that I think is the kind of connective tissue between them all is this incredible attention to detail and attention to sound. It really, like, there's not a lot of wasted space or wasted sounds. Like, it seems really important to you as a producer, as a songwriter, and somebody who puts this music together to really have everything matter that's kind of in the mix.
I mean, yeah, I don't know what to say. That's exactly what I what I want. So yeah, that's the perfect explanation. yeah, what else is there to say to that? Yeah, that is totally what I go for, and I guess I just think that there's a big difference between live music and recorded music.
Mm.
Not that recorded music has to be perfect, because I love flaws and I love things that are off kilter as well, and I love using those as well, and mistakes as well. I use that a lot. But I do like the fact that everything is very well thought through, because once it's recorded, it's documented, and that's how it will be. And I think that if you spend so much time on making something, you want it to be relevant, or at least try to be relevant for numerous years. You want to try and make something that isn't just a product of its time, but something that hopefully, you know, can stand the test of time, and that has something universal and timeless in it. So that is something that I'm very meticulous and very aware of and very focused on when I make music. And it goes into the sounds, it goes into the songwriting as well, and it goes into the overall production and arrangement as well. And it is definitely from listening to a lot of music from, you know, the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, where I do think that, you know, the business was bigger, so you had more people involved, you had more geniuses working on the same song, and you spent a lot of time on some of these albums, you know, like the some of these amazing albums that we still listen to took three or four years.
Very true.
Know? And that is very different in this day and age, where, you know, we're consumers and we need to, you know, push out product all the time, and, you know, time is money and this whole thing. And therefore, to me, it, you know, because I really enjoy these albums and I still listen to them, I want to, you know, I want to try and get some of that into what I do, you know, today. So most albums that I do work on do take 1 to 2 years to make. Mm-hmm. I haven't made an album in shorter time. The Rye record took 1.5 years. The Quadrant album took 2 years. And there's a lot of editing and choices that has to be made in that process. You know, there's, like I said, with the Quadrant album, there was 50 songs, and 20 of those were fully orchestrated.
Oh, wow.
Like, fully. But we only chose 10.
Did you actually record all those songs?
Yeah. We tracked all of it, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty intense. And we had, you know, we had 3 songs with Pharrell. We had 2 songs with Rafael Sadiq. We had a song with Kendrick that didn't make it. Kendrick Lamar as well. And we had a lot of songs that definitely were good. It just didn't fit, you know. And I think that is also something that we're gradually just becoming worse at, is editing and actually just choosing what really works. And that's also the thought behind both Rye's album and Quadrant's album only being 10 songs.
Yeah.
Wanting it to be an album, you know, that is cohesive and that works and is thought of, instead of just a selection of, you know, 15, 20 songs, which is what most urban or urban influenced albums are nowadays.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost like they don't know what they want, and they just end up choosing a little bit of everything. You know,
well, I mean, it may be part of what they want is they want to have more product out there that people can potentially buy.
True.
And focusing on that quantity as opposed to quality is, you know, part of the problem with a lot of mainstream music. And a couple, because started off as a purely independent musician all the way in Denmark, and then coming to the States and getting greater exposure, but still largely through independent labels. And then in the last couple of years, kind of getting major backing, there are kind of a couple of aspects of how that's, what I'm curious about, that in terms of how it's kind of changed you as an artist and a musician and all that. And some of it, I think one part of it is on the production aspect, because it's clear between the first Quadrant record and this Quadrant record that they are different, completely different beasts in terms of production. And I imagine some of that has to do with the differences in budget and all that. I'm also really interested, and I'll probably come back to it, because there may be kind of like follow-up questions connected to the production aspect, but I'm really interested also just in kind of how it affects your sensibilities as an artist once you kind of make that jump. You know, I would imagine it's kind of like somebody who grew up working class their whole lives, and then they make something and make a lot of money from it.
Yeah.
And now they can't really say they're in the working class anymore. No. They're in the upper class. Like, that's in some ways your position as a musician now. But first, I really wanted to kind of focus on process and production. So just in thinking about that, kind of the differences between making that first Quadrant record and making this record now with additional backing and like a real proper budget.
Yeah.
So what could you say about that?
Well, I mean, you're right. Like, they do sound different. And I think also we could have made the same album, because I still, you know, enjoy that production. But to me, it's important that whenever I start on something, I wanna develop. I wanna do something that I haven't done before, because I feel if I've already done it, the only thing I can get out of it would be to be compared to what I already did.
Yeah.
And I think it's important to move, you know, and constantly move and develop and grow. So we always talked about that, you know, if we ever did take the check, so to speak, and went that route, that it would be great to, you know, make the album that we'd always envisioned, you know, lush and with, you know, a tremendous amount of detail, that would have the reminiscences of that era of 70s and 80s where you just put the string section on there, you know, regardless of if it was a dance song or of a ballad, you know, and you know, the 32-piece band, you just, you know, you had to put it on, you know, just because, you know, you wanted that. Like, why wouldn't you want that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it sounds amazing.
Yeah.
Nowadays, it's a little bit different, you know. It's looked as an unnecessary cost.
Yeah.
You know, and I think the musicality of that is just, it's amazing. It's colors, you know, that we're just stripped of now. And I've missed that, and just missed the opportunity to do that, because I was born way later. So having that opportunity was definitely something that we wanted to pursue in making that album. It's true, there are different there's a different pressure on you, and there's different expectations. But I will have to say, though, that, and maybe this is just me having been extremely fortunate and lucky, but both albums, the Rye album and the Quadrant album, was made without any involvement. So it's, you know, 100% our realization, or, you know, our creation that we came with. And part of that is probably that as Quadrant, we already had a concept, a project, a sound when we signed, whereas a lot of acts and a lot of artists or singers and whatnot, they get signed before they've actually really done something. They've done a couple of demos, but we already had something, you know, it was in the making, but they knew what they got.
Yeah.
And so they had much more belief in us, and they gave us, actually they just gave us a year to work in studios and use musicians, and they were, you know, we got to do the album that we wanted to do.
Yeah.
And then all the other blah, blah, blah came in, you know, later down the line. And that always comes in. But end of the day, the album that you're sitting with is the album that we wanted to make. And with Rye, the album was already done before we signed with a major.
Mm.
So, you know, and that was the whole, you know, that was the whole argumentation and selling point was that, you know, we'll do it, but only if this is the album and nothing gets changed.
Mm.
You know, like this is what needs to be released. So I've been very fortunate in this regard, you know, whereas I know most of the times as a debut act, you don't have a lot to say.
Yeah.
You know, so I've only been interested in doing it because we've been able to do it on our terms.
Mm.
And with the music not changing. And the reason I think why I was able to do that also was because I've worked in the music business and lived off of music for 10 years actually now.
Mm-hmm.
And before these things, 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I was doing okay without it, you know. So I wasn't just taking it to get the check or to, you know, pay for my rent. I knew the hustle and I knew how to grind, you know. So it was because I saw that it was possible to do something bigger, you know, and get the music even more out there and just have more people work it instead of me and two people on some indie label. There's all of a sudden there's a huge company that needs to work it, you know, because they betted on it, they gambled on it,
mm-hmm.
and that makes for a different culture and also for a different process altogether. I mean, end of the day, I wouldn't say that there's necessarily one thing that's better than the other, and it's something that every artist kind of has to make up their mind about what it is that they want to do and how they want to do it, and both have advantages and disadvantages for sure. But I'm happy I did it solely because I was able to still keep the music the way I wanted it to.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, kind of the approach that you've had and in some respects still have to making music kind of allows you to weather whatever storms may or may not come. You know, that it's I would not, and you know, it's good I can tell you this in person. You know, like I would not expect you to all of a sudden have a real drop off in quality, kind of chasing a hit, chasing that money,
kind of
thing, because in a lot of respects, you know, you've done it both ways, and you're totally comfortable, kind of in that space. One of the things though with this kind of added budget and the ability to use more musicians, because so much of the early recordings was pretty much just you, right? And I would imagine, just given the time frame for when the Rye record was recorded, that again it was mainly just you and Mike.
Yeah.
But now you like it's, you know, like it is. It's like the 32-piece orchestra and all that.
Yeah.
You know, so do you still feel like the kind of the way we kind of talked about this music and kind of trying to put it into a genre was as electronic soul, but especially with this latest Quadrant record, and I would imagine kind of what comes next from Rye, it seems like it'll be less and less electronic and more. I don't know exactly the word I want to use, but you know what I'm saying.
I think I know what you mean. I think it's always really important for me that there's some organic elements, and if that is, you know, the strings that makes it organic, or if it's the drums that make it organic, or whatever it is, I love the imperfections of real instrumentation, even if they're amazing players. It's just the frequencies and the harmonies of real instruments just makes for a different quality than something that's been quantized and chopped up and edited to perfection.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, so I don't know where things are going. I don't really view it that way, because I always add like electronic elements into the music, and it just really depends on the project. It depends on what you know, what people can afford as well. Like I do productions for other artists as well. I've started to do it even more the last 3 or 4 months, ever since kind of these big out like albums or the like my part of it is kind of over with, mm-hmm. in many ways now. So it just depends on what the artist is, what they want, and I enjoy the differences sonically as well, you know. And I don't know what the next thing will be, but I definitely have like a musical rash right now in my body.
Yeah, that you're itching to get some new things.
That is itching, and I think I'm probably becoming more and more ideological with age as well, in regards to focus on the good song and also like the good arrangement, you know, and less worried about like how much is this and how much is that, like how much is of it is this is electronic or how much of it is organic, or is this the, you know, the modern drum sounds, or is it not, or, you know, like it matters less and less to me. I'm still super interested in it, and I research it, and I'm excited about it, but it matters less and less because I've recognized that it doesn't really mean that much. Mm. I think it's probably also something that you're more focused on when you're younger, when you're in your like start 20s, and as a teenager, you're more interested in sound, and everything, and a lot of these days is sound design. Mm-hmm. You know, like a lot of music is more designed than it's an actual like song.
Yeah.
You know, that actually does something to you.
Mm-hmm.
And that has probably given me even more of an incentive to make it more musical and make it more live, you know, because I feel that there is this crazy sound design thing going on right now that I'm just so over and so tired of. I thought it was really interesting when it happened, you know, 10 years ago, and I've done it a little bit, and the Wus und Hannibal record, which was the first album I kind of like really did, had a lot of that. Mm-hmm. It had a lot of like the beat elements, because I thought it was interesting to mix up. But then through the years, I feel like it's gotten to be more and more just beats, and less focus on the actual songs. And I only think the beats are interesting if it's mixed with songs and music. So that's probably the answer to your question, is that it's probably a little bit of a reaction,
yeah.
to that, you know, that I'm a little tired of a lot of form and not a lot of content, uh-huh. sometimes.
Well, you know, we're going to have to figure out something, you know, a new term for this at some point.
Yeah.
Just want to let you guys know, we are talking right now to Robin Hannibal, who is in both the band Quadrin and also Rye. Rye is going to be performing next Saturday as part of the Culture Collide Festival, performing at the church in Echo Park. We actually have tickets for the festival. And in addition to Rye, it's an incredible festival going on all weekend. Alice Russell is going to be performing, King Khan and the Shrines, a variety of different artists all over kind of the Echo Park area and other parts of Los Angeles. We'll have tickets for that a little bit later. I wanted to talk to you a little bit, because I think in some ways this actually, it connects to what we were just mentioning and how the kind of changing dynamics of your career and also the changing dynamics of your sound. There also is this, I guess we could call it a solo project,
yeah.
which is Bobby. And some of these elements seem like they're also kind of being worked out in the way you put together music for this project.
Yeah.
And could you say a little bit about kind of what, because I also thought, especially with the EP that came out a little while ago,
yeah.
that it seemed that Bobby might be kind of an avenue for a bit more kind of avant-garde-y yeah. kind of arrangements.
Yeah.
So could you talk a little bit about this project?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, it kind of came about that way because these were songs that I had lying and I tried to push to different artists.
Yeah.
And they would hear it and they'd be like, oh, it's interesting, but it's a little off.
Mm.
And then I just, in the end, thought, you know, I might as well just do it on my own. Because I always demo songs, you know. Sometimes I demo them completely with, you know, verse, chorus, blah, 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 blah. But most of the times I just demo them a tad because I want whatever singer, artist to kind of imagine what they could do to it, like what they can add to it. So, you know, I had done that and I just thought it might be interesting if I actually like really did it, like really sang them properly, which I never do. I just demo things like once, you know. Whereas if I record somebody, we'll do 20 takes and I'll take the best take, you know. Like it's a process getting to the great recording. And like you stack all these different harmonies and elements and you double the lead and the vocals and blah, blah, blah. I thought that'd be interesting if I actually just tried that out with my own voice. And so I did. And it was it was an experiment using songs that I wasn't using for anybody else. And I thought it had something. So I just ended up releasing it. And then I just haven't had time to do more, actually, and often wanted to. And then I had two songs lying around that I have to, though, admit aren't actually new. They are some years old. This last one I did the year I came to the States, 2010, late 2010, and the other one that has also just been released was made in March 2010. So they're actually 3 years old. And I've developed, I think, hopefully, knock on wood, a little bit vocally as well since, but I'm still waiting for the little period of time where I can kind of get in again and you know, do something that is me now and is a little bit more developed vocally as well. But I really enjoy these two songs that are a couple of years old, and I thought it'd be fun to kind of release them, and I'm doing a video for it as well. And you know, it's fun because it's a different side, and I enjoy it.
Why don't we listen to one of these tracks from Robin Hannibal's project, Bobby. This is one of these new songs. It's actually an old song, but it's a new song to us, at least, for the most part. This one is Tame the Shrew, released on Matthew Schreier's Kieris Chicle record label. You're hearing it right now on KPFK and Melting Pot.
Oh,
Music from Robin Hannibal as Bobby here on KPFK and Melting Pot. Tame the Shrew, the name of the song, releases a digital, only digital, correct?
So far,
only yes. Digital single by Matthew Schreier's record label, Kiaris Chicle. And Robin Hannibal is here in the studio with us. I think in some respects, one of the reasons that I wanted you to come in was just so I could settle, you know, where the kind of the reference was for the song. It was Janet Jackson, more or less, kind of unconsciously, it seems.
But
the Jacksons loom large.
Oh,
it
for
seems,
sure, for sure.
I mean, in the mind of Robin Hannibal,
for yeah. sure. I mean, the regards to voice, like Coco can reach for a young MJ, but I think I'll have to settle for Janet. I don't mind that at all. But yeah. it definitely has that, and you know, the this kind of ostinato synthesizer jazz bass line, you know, where you kind of play the chord is a very Rod Temperton-ish type of thing, and he was one of the chief songwriters on Michael Jackson's albums,
yeah.
And this white British dude from I believe it's like Oxford or something, and he was in Heatwave to begin with, and then he was recruited by Quincy, and he did a lot of these songs that has these very like signature synth bass lines that never really move, and then things move around it, and that was a big inspiration as well. And then obviously early Janet is really
When you listen to a track like that, like it sounds it like it's, you know, it's an upbeat track, like it's a track that moves you, and it sounds like in singing like you're having a good time, but it's singing is like it's always been kind of Robin Hannibal and somebody through almost all these different projects.
Yeah.
Are you getting more comfortable with your voice?
Yeah, I think I am. I mean, I'll tell you a quick anecdote if that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
I had a moment where I really discovered as well that, you know, it's in many ways also about owning it. We had the big pleasure of working with Pharrell for this Quadron album, and even though none of the songs we made with him made the album, it was a big experience because I never get to work with any other producers. I'm always the producer in the room.
Yeah,
you know, and it was so liberating to see somebody that were in many ways working the same way as me. At least me and Coco were sitting there kind of laughing because it felt, you know, it felt very much like now I had to experience what it is to be her.
Yeah.
Yeah. but what I thought was great was that, you know, and he's, I mean, I really enjoy his singing, but, you know, you wouldn't maybe say that he's a natural singer either, mm-hmm. but I think he has a really, really good voice. And he has great sense of melody and understanding as well. Mm-hmm. But he just didn't care. Like he wasn't too interested in sounding perfect or he had no ego in regards to his voice.
Yeah.
Like it was just an extension of him. And that was so liberating to see that somebody that known and that acclaimed had no problem just kind of like taking his heart out and like putting it on the table, mm. you know, and have everybody to like dissect.
Mm-hmm.
And that made me change a little bit my perception as well about voice, because I think especially with voice, there's a whole, you know, is the person a good singer or a bad singer?
Mm.
Like there's a lot of like technicality or techniques, technique involved in it, or mm-hmm. like is it good or is it bad?
Yeah.
But it really, what it really is, it's emotion, mm-hmm. you know, and it's some kind of quality that makes you want to connect. And that's how I look at it now. So that definitely, that made me change that. So yeah, I am much more comfortable with it now. At least also to the point where if I'm sitting with somebody, I'll just start singing away, not caring, you know, if it's the right notes or if it's not, you know, just let's just share.
That's good. That's good. You know, I mean, it's you're already making, you know, fantastic music, but I imagine this is, you know, really going to open up some new doors,
you know.
as you move forward. I mean, you're getting hopefully, I think right now, kind of much deserved time off after all these projects. But yeah, it still fills us with, you know, some hope and anticipation of what will come in the ensuing years from the variety of different projects. And it's really been a pleasure once again.
Likewise,
to talk
sir.
With you. You know, thank you so much for coming in.
It's been an utmost pleasure, and I haven't done this since we did it last time, I think. And I wanted to do it again because I enjoyed it so much last time.
We actually, originally when we talked about this, we were going to have you do like a guest DJ set, and you and I, we just got to talking and you know, that's the way it goes. But you know, hopefully sometime in the near future, I really would love to have you come in again. You know, and maybe give us a taste of what's new, but also play some tunes.
Yeah, I'd love to.
Okay.
Love to.
Yeah, thank you so much once again, Robin.
Pleasure.
I'm going to leave you with some music from Rye. They once again are performing as part of the Culture Collide Festival that's going on here in Los Angeles Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, October 10th, 11th, and 12th at a variety of different venues. Rye is going to play on Saturday, October 12th at the Church in Echo Park. The tickets that we have two pairs of these, and they actually are for the entire festival. So you'll be able to get into the different shows as long as there's space. But you'll be able to see a variety of the different acts, and I really do highly recommend that on Saturday you go and see Rye. So call us now, 818-985-5735, if you're interested in tickets to the Culture Collide Festival, which features Alice Russell, King Khan and the Shrines, and Rye, in addition to a wide variety of other bands going on the 10th, 11th, and 12th of October this coming weekend. Call us now for that, 818-985-5735. I'll leave you with one track from Rye. This one is Last Dance, once again from their album Woman. And that'll pretty much close it out for us, I think, here at Melting Pot. Folk Scene's up next. And y'all take care. And thanks once again, Robin, for coming in.
Pleasure.
Tell me lies and lullabies, but don't tell me to change.
Don't give me that face.